Hey, everybody, it's 6 past the hour, and this is Indirect Democracy. On this episode of Indirect Democracy, we'll be taking a look at the role of the Vice President. Plus, we'll be having the global warming update, the President's love horoscope, a public service announcement, and, of course, the What a Weenie Award. And welcome. Welcome to podcast number 33 of Indirect Democracy, found at www.indirectdemocracy.com. I am your host. My name is David. And welcome. And just so we know, let's get this straight out the door. Indirect Democracy is a very proud member of the Progressive Podcast Network. If you would like to find that website for the Progressive Podcast Network and all the fabulous podcasts that are produced by this wonderful group of individuals and, of course, teams, I didn't mean to leave anybody out, you can find them at www.progressivepodcastnetwork.org or at their blog site and forum site at newmediarevolutionaries.com. You can find the links for those sites at the homepage for Indirect Democracy. Just go down a little bit on the scroll of the page and you will find the links to those websites. But thank you for joining me for podcast number 33, trying to get this one posted before the election. But before I begin with the role of the Vice President, which I thought this was just fun to go over because it was such a, I'm not even sure if it's worthy of being a full news story, but because it's become a topic du jour, a little bit of a topic of conversation as to what the role of the Vice President is, because it seems that the current Republican nominee is having trouble understanding it, or maybe not. We'll get into that. I just wanted to encourage you all to vote. Get your friends out there, vote. I know I live in the Los Angeles area, in the Southern California area. I know that it's a little bit difficult if you live in LA County to try to get out there and vote. To be exact, I'm in the Orange County area. And it seems like you can vote even at the mall here in Orange County. LA County, a little tough, but I encourage you, whatever state you are, go to Google, type in the state you are, type in early voting, see what comes up, go to those sites, find out what you can, if you can vote beforehand. Or if it comes down to Tuesday, do vote. Get out there and vote. Put aside at least an hour or two to make sure that you get this done, because this is it. This is the big election we've all been waiting for, and it is time. But before we get into other topics and before I get off track, it is time to give you the global warming update. Now, I dedicate this portion of the podcast in an attempt to inform you about issues and matters that revolve around the subject of global warming or global climate change. And this particular story is entitled China Predicts Climate Phenomena from Global Warming. This is from ABC News Australia, and the article reads, in releasing a major policy document on climate change, the Chinese government has warned that global warming has already had massive adverse effects on China. A major policy paper on climate change has warned of the difficulty of reducing the country's reliance on coal and the potential devastation that this could cause. According to the so-called white paper, extreme climate phenomena, such as high temperature, heavy precipitation, and severe droughts have increased in frequency and intensity. Xi Jianhua, a deputy chief of the National Development and Reform Commission, said China's emissions have caught up with the United States and will not fall soon. The paper also warns that China's coal-dominated energy mix cannot be quickly changed, making control of greenhouse gases rather difficult. The paper follows China calling on wealthy nations like Australia to contribute 1% of their wealth to fix global warming. Now, if you would like to find any of the links to these stories, you can find them at the research links for Indirect Democracy. Go to the side links for research links to the side tabs, and you'll find research 31 through 35, and you'll find the links for all the stories that I will read to you from this in that area. Okay, well, it's that time of the podcast to give out the President's Love Horoscope, and it occurred to me recently that I don't believe that either one of the candidates for office is a Cancer. And the fun thing about the giving out the President's Love Horoscope was based upon the fact that our President is, in fact, a Cancer. Astrologically and symbolically, physically, you go for whatever it is you want to call him. Simple fact of the matter is, to me, and to a lot of people, he is a Cancer. So, because it's fun to have with it, and because you can't get better astrological advice than that from the wild and wonderful pages of Elle Magazine or Elle.com, here is the President's, President Bush's, love horoscope for the week of October 26th, 2008. And to get it started, you need the music. Feels so good. Yes.
You're lying here next to me.
Mr. President, your love meter reading is an 8.
You have no idea.
You boil over with emotional passion. You know how to make someone want you by luring him or her closer, then playing hard to get when it comes time to close the deal. Is that what you've been doing with our foreign adversaries, Mr. President? Playing a little hard to get. Oh yeah. I call this Victorian foreplay, and you're masterful at it. For those of you attending Halloween parties in costume, you're even hotter and less inhibited than ever. So break out that pilot outfit, President Bush. Land your love plane on Laura or Condi. On somebody. You need to get that out, Mr. President. Because you say and do what you're normally too distracted or afraid to. Whether you're dressed up as a seductive vampire, or Sarah Palin in moose hunting garb. Seriously, that's what's inside this horoscope. You have an intoxicating impact on unsuspecting party guests. Because you're so unexpectedly bold. You're able to get away with a lot. Oh yes, Mr. President. You will have fun. Your weekly touchstones are sunstone and watermelon tourmaline. And that is your presidential love horoscope for the week of October 26th, 2008. Okay, I let the music go on too long. I love that song. I'm actually going to miss the President's Love Horoscope. Well, maybe we'll keep it around if it's John McCain. That would be fun. But it is time for an ad from the Progressive Podcast Network.
To kind of catapult some propaganda. In my line of work, you got to keep repeating things over and over and over again. To kind of catapult some propaganda.
Oh, really, George? Greetings, this is Jack Clark. Listen to me catapult some truth back at that SOB and his entire gang of right-wing thugs. My podcast is called Blast the Right. I use facts and logic to kick right-wing butt. We'll have interviews, listener phone calls, and knock-down, drag-out debates with foaming at the mouth right wingers. Is there any other type? Search for Blast the Right in iTunes, Yahoo, Google. You'll find me. Check it out right now. Remember, Blast the Right.
Okay, one of the things that I found rather interesting over the past couple of weeks, maybe the past month, has been the discussion about the role of the vice president. Because it really is the key issue that a lot of people do focus on when it comes to Sarah Palin in particular. That issue which comes up as to not only is she qualified, but does she even understand what the role of the vice president is, what that person's duties are when they're in office. Well, to understand it a little bit myself, and because I felt it was important to not just understand for myself, but just to share with you, I actually went to the Senate's website and ran a little search about vice presidents of the United States. And what I have here from Their website, and written by Mark Hatfield with the Senate Historical Office, is a abridged little thing from called Vice Presidents of the United States, 1789 to 1993. And, of course, you know, Dick Cheney's on this list, of course, but I want to read to you the passages and information that I found there that I thought were quite interesting, and just to share with you them. Now, here's the article. Holding the least understood, most ridiculed, and most often ignored constitutional office in the federal government, American vice presidents have included some remarkable individuals. 14 of the 44 former vice presidents have become president of the United States, more than half of them after a president had died. One defeated the sitting president with whom he served. One murdered a man and became a fugitive. One joined the Confederate Army and led an invasion of Washington, D.C. One was the wealthiest banker of his era. One received the Nobel Prize and composed a popular melody. One served as a corporal in the Coast Guard while vice president. One had cities in Oregon and Texas named after him. Two resigned the office. Two were never elected by the people. One was the target of a failed assassination plot. One was mobbed in his car while on a goodwill mission. Seven died in office, one in his room in the U.S. Capitol, and two fatally stricken while on their way to preside over the Senate. And one piano-playing vice president suffered political repercussions from a photograph showing him playing that instrument while famous movie actress Lauren Bacall posed seductively on top of it. The stories of these diverse individuals attempt to sketch the development of the vice presidency itself, that colorful, important, and routinely disparaged American political institution. Now, from the section called Constitutional Origins and Structural Changes of the Vice Presidency, here is how the vice president is set up through the electoral system. Our Constitution's framers created the vice presidency almost as an afterthought. In setting up a system for electing presidents, they devised an electoral college and provided that each of its members was to vote for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be inhabitant of the same state with themselves. In those days, when loyalty to one state was stronger than to the new nation, the framers recognized that individual electors might be inclined to choose a leader from their own immediate political circle, creating the danger of a crippling deadlock as no one candidate would win a plurality of all votes cast. By being required to select one candidate from outside their own state, electors would be compelled to look for individuals of national stature. Under the system the framers created, the candidate receiving the most electoral votes would be president, the one coming in second would be vice president. In the election of 1800, however, the constitutional system for electing presidents broke down as both Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr received the same number of electoral votes. This impasse threw the contest into the House of Representatives, where, for 35 separate ballots, neither candidate was elected. When the stalemate was finally broken, the House elected Jefferson president, thus making Burr our third vice president. With 4 years of this deadlocked election, Congress had passed, and the necessary number of states had ratified the 12th Amendment to the Constitution, instituting the present system wherein electors cast separate ballots for president and for vice president. Now, as Alexander Hamilton noted in the Federalist Paper No. 68, New York's 1977 Constitution provided for a lieutenant governor chosen by the people at large who presides in the Senate and is the constitutional substitute for the governor in casualties similar to those which would authorize the vice president to exercise the authorities and discharge the duties of the president. The Constitution established the office of vice president primarily to provide a successor in the event of the president's death, disability, or resignation. The document, however, was vague about the way presidential succession would work, stating only that in cases of presidential death or disability, the powers and duties of the said office shall devolve on the vice president. This from Article 2, Section 1 of the Constitution. So what did devolve mean? Would the vice president become acting president until another was chosen? Or would he become president in his own right? A half century would pass before the nation would have to address this murky constitutional language, although the Constitution's framers kept their intentions about presidential succession shrouded in ambiguity. They left no doubt about vice presidential succession. There was to be none in the absence of the vice president, or when he shall exercise the office of the president of the United States, the Senate would simply choose a president pro temp. The framers' failure to provide a method for filling a vice presidential vacancy continued to plague the nation. In 1792, Congress made a stab at addressing the problem by adopting the Presidential Succession Act, providing that if a president should die when there was no vice president, the Senate pro temp and the Speaker of the House of Representatives in that order would succeed to office. In 1886, responding to concern that few presidents pro temp had executive branch experience, Congress altered the line of succession to substitute for the congressional officials cabinet officers in order of rank, starting with the Secretary of State. In 1947, after the vice presidency had been vacant for most of a presidential term, Congress again changed the line of succession. Concerned that cabinet officers had not been elected, it named the House Speaker as the first official to succeed if a president died during a vacancy in the vice presidency followed by the president pro temp of the Senate. Finally, after the death of President Kennedy in 1963 and the resulting vice presidential vacancy, Congress debated what became the second constitutional amendment related to the structure of the vice presidency. In 1967, the 25th Amendment addressing presidential vacancy and disability became part of our Constitution. The absence of any provision for filling a vice presidential vacancy had become intolerable in the nuclear age. The amendment states that the president may appoint a vice president to fill a vacancy in that office subject to approval by both houses of Congress. And accordingly, here are the vice presidential duties. The framers also devoted scant attention to the vice president's duties, providing only that he shall be president of the Senate, but shall have no vote unless they be evenly divided. In practice, the number of times vice presidents have exercised this right has varied greatly. John Adams holds the record of 29 votes, followed closely by John Calhoun with 28. Since the 1870s, however, no vice president has cast as many as 10 tie-breaking votes. While vice presidents have used their votes chiefly on legislative issues, they have also broken ties on the election of Senate officers, as well as the appointment of committees in 1881, when the parties were evenly represented in the Senate. The vice president's other constitutionally mandated duty was to receive from the states the tally of electoral ballots cast for president and vice president, and to open the certificates in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, so that the total votes could be counted. This comes from Article 2, Section 1. Only a few happy vice presidents, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson, Martin Van Buren, and George Bush, had the pleasure of announcing their own election as president. Many more were chagrined to announce the choice of some rival for the office. Several framers ultimately refused to sign the Constitution, in part because they viewed the vice president's legislative role as a violation of the separation of powers doctrine. Elbridge Gerry, who would later serve as vice president, declared that the framers might as well put the president himself as the head of the legislature. Others thought the office unnecessary, but agreed with Connecticut delegate Roger Sherman that if the vice president were not to be president of the Senate, he would be without employment, and some member of the Senate would act as presiding officer, who would be deprived of his vote. Under the original Code of Senate Rules, the presiding officer exercised great power over the conduct of the body's proceedings. Rule 16 provided that every question of order shall be decided by the president of the Senate without debate, but if there be a doubt in mind, he may call for assent of the Senate. Thus, contrary to later practice, the presiding officer was the sole judge of proper procedure, and his rulings could not be turned aside by the full Senate without his assent. The first two vice presidents, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, did much to shape the nature of the office, setting precedents that were followed by others. During most of the 19th century, the degree of influence and the role played within the Senate depended chiefly on the personality and inclinations of the individual involved. Some had great parliamentary skill and presided well, while others found the task boring, were incapable of maintaining order, or chose to spend most of their time away from Washington, leaving the duty to a president pro temp. Some made an effort to preside fairly, while others used their position to promote the political agenda of the administration. During the 20th century, the role of the vice president has evolved into more of an executive branch position. Now, the vice president is usually seen as an integral part of a president's administration, and presides over the Senate only on ceremonial occasions or when a tie-breaking vote may be needed. Yet even though the nature of the job has changed, it is still greatly affected by the personality and skills of the individual incumbents. The nation's first vice presidents were men of extraordinary ability. Both John Adams and Thomas Jefferson gained the office as runners-up in a presidential contest, with the support of those who believed they were amply qualified to hold a top office. Each recognized in assuming this new and as yet loosely defined position that his action would set precedents for future vice presidents. But one precedent established by Adams and Jefferson would not be repeated for over three decades. Although both men won election as president immediately following their terms, no sitting vice president would repeat this pattern until 1836. John Adams maintained a cordial but distant relationship with the president, who sought his advice only occasionally. In the Senate, Adams played a more active role, particularly during his first term. On at least one occasion, he persuaded senators to vote against legislation he opposed, and he frequently lectured the body on procedural and policy matters. He supported Washington's policies by casting the 29 tie-breaking votes that no successor has equaled. Jefferson's situation would prove to be unique in all the nation's history. No one expected Jefferson to be President Adams' principal assistant. Instead, he devoted his four-year term to preparing himself for the next presidential election and to drafting a guidebook on legislative procedure. Jefferson hoped that his manual of parliamentary practice would allow him and his successors to preside over the Senate with fairness, intelligence, and consistency. That classic guide has retained its usefulness to both the Senate and House of Representatives through the intervening two centuries. Of Vice President John C. Calhoun, Calhoun approached his legislative duties with gravity, dedication, and concern for maintaining order not seen since the time of Adams and Jefferson. A scrupulous guardian of the Senate's written rules, he disdained its unwritten customs and practices. After a quarter century of ineffective or incapacitated vice presidents, the Senate chafed under Calhoun's tutelage and began a lengthy examination of the role of its presiding officer. An interesting character within the vice presidential history was that of Vice President John Taylor. John Taylor wrote an important chapter in American presidential and vice presidential history in 1841 when William Henry Harrison became the first president to die in office. Interpreting the Constitution in a way that might have surprised its framers, Vice President Taylor refused to consider himself as acting president. What devolved on him at Harrison's death were not the powers and duties of the presidential office, he contended, but the office itself. Taylor boldly claimed the presidency, its full $25,000 salary, and all its prerogatives. Congressional leaders and members of Harrison's cabinets who were inclined to challenge Taylor eventually set aside their concerns in the face of the accomplished fact. 9 years later, when Vice President Millard Fillmore succeeded to the presidency after Zachary Taylor's death, no serious question was raised about the propriety of such a move. The vice presidency remained essentially a legislative position during the 19th century. Those who held it rarely attended cabinet meetings or otherwise involved themselves in executive branch business. Their usefulness to the president generally ended with the election, while those who had served in the Congress might offer helpful political information and connections to a presidential candidate, or just attract electoral votes in marginal states. Their status and value would evaporate after Inauguration Day. Beginning in the 20th century, the office of the vice president grew slowly but precipitably. The principal 20th century growth in the vice president's role occurred when the national government assumed a greater presence in American life, beginning with the New Deal era and extending through the Cold War years. During the 20th century, the focus of the vice presidency had shifted dramatically from being mainly a legislative position to a predominantly executive post. As modern era presidents began playing an increasing role as legislative agenda setters, their vice presidents regularly attended cabinet meetings and received executive assignments. Vice presidents represented their presidents' administrations on Capitol Hill, served on the National Security Council, chaired special commissions, acted as high-level representatives of the government to foreign heads of state, and assumed countless other chores, great and trivial, at the president's direction. Beginning with Richard Nixon, the occupied spacious quarters in the Executive Office Building and assembled staffs as specialists to extend their reach and influence. From fewer than 20 staff members at the end of Nixon's vice presidency, the number increased to 60 during the 70s with the addition of not only political and support staff, but advisors on domestic policy and national security. Vice President Mondale expanded the vice president's role as presidential advisor, establishing the tradition of weekly lunches with the president, and subsequent vice presidents have continued to be active participants in the administration. Quite often, vice presidents have often run afoul of cabinet secretaries whose territories they invaded. As administration lobbyists, they also irritated members of Congress. A favorite example noted by the author occurred in 1969. President Nixon had pledged to give his vice president a significant policymaking role and for the first time an office in the White House itself. Spiro Agnew was determined to make the most of that role and expand his legislative functions as well. Since he lacked previous legislative experience, he had the Senate parliamentarian tutor him on the intricacies of Senate floor procedure. Soon he began to inject himself into the course of Senate proceedings, contrary to the well-worn practice that constrained his predecessors. During a debate over anti-ballistic missile treaties, Agnew approached Idaho Republican Senator Len Jordan and asked how he was going to vote. "You can't tell me how to vote," said the shocked senator. "You can't twist my arm." At the next regular luncheon of Republican senators, Jordan accused Agnew of breaking the separation of powers by lobbying on the Senate floor and announced the Jordan rule. Under his rule, if the vice president tried to lobby him on anything, the senator would automatically vote the other way. Agnew concluded from this experience, "After trying for a while to get along with the Senate, I decided I would go down to the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue and try playing the executive game." As a final piece to the story, in 1886, the Senate initiated the practice of honoring former vice presidents by acquiring marble busts of those who had held the office, with the expenses paid from the contingent fund of the Senate. The previous year, in 1885, the Senate had placed in the vice president's room a bust of Henry Wilson, who had died in that room a decade earlier. Under the 1886 resolution, busts of former vice presidents, beginning with those of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, were placed in the niches around the gallery level of the Senate chamber. Once those 20 spaces were filled, the Senate adopted an amended resolution in 1898 to place future vice presidential busts elsewhere within the Senate wing of the Capitol. This practice continues today. So why bring up this story? Well, as many of you may know, during a recent interview with the press and answering a child's question, vice presidential nominee for the Republican Party, Governor Sarah Palin, stated that the vice president presides over the Senate. Now, after reading this piece from the Senate website, which I will have linked up to the research links of Indirect Democracy, it occurred to me that way back then, part of it was to preside over the Senate. It was, in fact, two of our greatest leaders who began as vice presidents who set up the very parliamentary rules that are still followed by the Senate. Vice presidents acting in a legislative manner. Of course, the slippery slope and the dangerous side of this comes up when we look at what Vice President Cheney said, that he is part of a fourth branch of the government. Neither executive nor legislative, he falls within a gray, murky area. And this is where this article comes up, because of the role of the vice president, which we can no doubt say is not legislative, and would be silly enough to say that it wasn't executive. It is clearly executive because of its place within Article 2 of the Constitution. There it is, the executive branch. Listed under it, the vice president. But the role of the vice president, we would have to admit, would allow us to live within some type of laughable la-la land if we did not admit or believe that even though they may get laughed out of offices or meetings or thrown out of the Senate floor if they were to go up and try to lobby in any way, is the simple fact that the vice president is the main lobbyist for the president. He will seek out and try to establish and get the votes for a president. To think otherwise really is sort of naive and foolish, and I think is based upon solely just arguing for the sake of argument for this particular year. Was Governor Palin correct? Well, only partly. As we have found out through history, the role of the vice president has gone from legislative to more executive, probably somewhere where it should have been within its role within the Constitution. But to say that the vice president has no legislative role within constitutional means, well, I think is just to argue against Palin herself, and that serves us no purpose. And that really is the purpose of this particular statement, that while I am no fan of Governor Palin, except for when she plays my naughty librarian in my head, we have to look at the historical role of the vice president and realize that besides being the person that is there to take over in case the president is disabled, resigns, or God forbid something happens to our president, the role of the vice president is to be the president of the Senate, to preside over it, its parliamentary rules and functions, and yes, cast deciding votes when necessary. clearly legislative duties, or at least a legislative duty. But they are also an executive member. They are part of the executive branch of our government. It is an undefined and continuously changing function within our government. Imagine that. Our constitution that constantly changes. But that's another topic. It is more important to realize that when we talk about our constitution and the role of our vice presidents, we have to ask ourselves in every way, shape, and form what their duties will be. If we look at Governor Palin, will she have the ability, will she have the knowledge to go and work with different members of the Senate, having no experience within that branch of government, to work with them on different matters, to talk with them, to know and understand legislative and parliamentary procedures, if necessary? Will she understand and know the personalities that are involved? On that level, you have to say no. Would Joe Biden know that? Yes, because he's been within that branch for 32 years. And maybe that's also his downfall. 32 years means he knows the game too well, and maybe he's too much part of the establishment. But when we look at the role of the vice president, we have to remember every aspect of what it is when we say, is that person qualified to be vice president? Not just to be the person that sits around and waits and goes to funerals and wonders if they'll ever rise in ascendancy to the presidency. No, we have to also ask, will they be capable to do the job that is necessary? Or will they do what other vice presidents have done? Go to their homes, write their books, and allow somebody else to do the job. In the current world that we live in, that latter cannot be the person that we have sitting in the number two chair. Okay, now it's time for a musical break, and here is a song by Michael Franti and the Spearhead. The song is entitled Say Hey, I Love You.
Bulldog Selecta!
Luck I had was you, and I know one thing that I love you. I say, hey, I'll be gone today, but I'll be back. Come around the way. It seems like everywhere I go, the more I see.
Okay, well, I don't know how many of you are suffering from a little bit of fatigue from going through news websites and political things almost on a constant daily basis. So this podcast was approached recently to put out a public service announcement, and here is that public service announcement.
And now, a public service announcement. It's been 20 months. 20 months of pure dedication on your part. Reading every website, going to every news site, reading everything from the Huffington Post to the Drudge Report, reading all the poll numbers that are coming through, checking every state, passing along emails and funny videos to friends and colleagues and family members. Yes, you have shown dedication to your candidate. And now as malaise sets in, as your eyes start to blur, you find yourself wondering, thinking, not only wondering when will it be over, but what you will do with your time after November 4th. Well, we, your good friends at Pornography, remind you that we've always been here for you. Straight, gay, lesbian, bi, curious, fetish, we're there for you. We've got it all. From pay sites to free sites, Pornography is still there. Yes, Pornography will always be here for you. This message is brought to you by your good friends at Pornography, who remind you, Pornography, it's what the internet was meant for.
Okay, well, it's that time of the podcast to give out the What a Weenie Award, and this one goes to conservative writer DeRoy Murdoch. Now, DeRoy Murdoch in September put out an article called Obama, Pay Equity for Thee, But Not for Me. And here's how the article goes. Now is the time to keep the promises of equal pay for an equal's day work. Democratic presidential nominee Barack Obama said August 28th in his convention acceptance speech. He told the crowd in Denver, "I want my daughters to have exactly the same opportunities as your sons." Obama's campaign website is even more specific. Under the heading, Fighting for Pay Equity, the Women's Issues page laments that despite decades of progress, women still only make 77 cents for every dollar a man makes. A recent study estimates it will take another 47 years for women to close the wage gap with men at Fortune 500 corporate offices. Barack Obama believes that the government needs to take better steps to enforce the Equal Pay Act. Obama's commitment to federally mandated pay equity stretches from the Rockies to Wall Street and beyond, and yet it seems to have eluded his United States Senate office. Compensation figures for his legislative staff reveal that Obama pays women just 83 cents for every dollar that his men make. A watchdog group called Legistorm posts online the salaries for Capitol Hill staffers. "We have no political affiliation," says the site, "and no political purpose except to make the workings of Congress as transparent as possible." Parsing Legistorm's official data gleaned from the Secretary of the Senate offers a fascinating glimpse at pay equity in the world's greatest deliberative body. Based on the calculations from this website, Obama's 28 male staffers divided among themselves total payroll expenditures of $1,523,120. Thus, Obama's average male employee earns $54,397. Obama's 30 female employees split $1,354,580 among themselves, or $45,152 on average. Why this disparity? One reason may be the underrepresentation of women in Obama's highest compensated ranks. Among Obama's 5 best paid advisors, only one was a woman. Among his top 20, 7 were women. Again, on average, Obama's female staffers earn just 83 cents for every dollar his male staffers make. This figure certainly exceeds the 77 cent threshold that Obama's campaign website condemns. However, 83 cents does not equal $1. In spite of the 17 cent gap between Obama's rhetoric and reality, he chose to try the GOP presidential contender John McCain on this issue. So, why would I give the What a Weenie Award to this man? Well, it's about to become obvious in the information I'm about to read to you, and this particular blog posting by Legistorm.com itself, and I'm going to have the link for Legistorm up on the research page for Indirect Democracy. Here is the title of this posting, Obama's Alleged Pay Gap. Over the last few days, a tempest has been brewing over an allegation made by columnist DeRoy Murdoch that Senator Obama pays less to women than he does to men in his Senate office. All the stories have accurately cited Legistorm as the source for the raw data. Naturally, the allegation has lit up the conservative blogosphere and made its way onto television, including ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos. But along the way, a few commentators have taken liberty with the facts about Legistorm's role, so we wanted to clear that up. We carry the data and are happy to be the source for anyone, liberal or conservative, who wants to do an analysis of that data. That's what it's there for, to provide openness in government and spark debate. We were not, however, the source for the analysis that led to the conclusion about equal pay. That analysis was solely done by Murdoch. We do not take a position either for or against Murdoch's analysis. We will simply note that there has been some debate about the validity of his claims because he did not include consideration of whether the men and women were doing equal work. Whether this criticism was valid is also something we do not take a position on. So I decided to go to Legistorm and check out Senator Obama's pay for his different legislative staffers. And the one thing that I found interesting, when you click on one of the names and you go down past their pay, is there's a statement. Congressional staff salaries shown are the amount paid in the period shown. They are not annual salaries. Because bonuses may be included here and other payments may not be, most noticeably with aides working for multiple office or for a political campaign committee, please use caution in extrapolating annual salaries from the figures shown here. That was the thing that caught me the most. These were not even annual salaries. These were pay summaries for periods worked, not for an annual time or an average thing. This is if you worked for a specific amount of time within this time, maybe they didn't even put in the same amount of hours as another employee put in, you would have disparities in how the pay went. Now, there are a multitude of names on this website. It looks like there has to be at least 60 names on this website. I didn't count. But what I started to do was just click on different names to find somebody, at least two people, one man, one woman. Somebody had to have the exact same job during the exact same time period. And wouldn't you know it, I found that information. This is for the time period of October 1st, 2007 through March 31st, 2008. The role, the position that this person played was legislative assistant. Here are the names of those two staffers, so you can look them up yourselves and check it out. The first one, Henry T. Atkinson. The second one, Dora L. Hughes. Mr. Atkinson, for the time period of October 1st through March 31st, 2008, earned exactly $41,499.96. Ms. Hughes earned exactly $41,499.96. The exact same amount of money for the exact same time period worked. All of this 6 months before these scurrilous and multiple accusations came out against Senator Obama's lack of equal pay. And this is why Mr. Murdoch earns the What a Weenie Award, because it is once again another example of taking information that they don't even take the time to look at, just glance it for what they need to get to put out an ugly and baseless rumor about a man's belief. Senator Obama did exactly what he should have done. Paid somebody for the work they did. Equal pay, equal work. Based solely upon their ability to do it. One man, one woman earned the exact amount of money. Mr. Murdoch couldn't even take the time to find out that information. Well, that crap has to end. That crap has to end because that email is being distributed out there. That email is one of many dozens that are just filled with simple lies that if anybody would take the time to just check and research would find that the information is incorrect. Whether it's Obama being a Muslim or him not, or Senator Obama not standing for equal pay, or saying that the Democrats and Senator Obama are alone responsible for the economic collapse. They're out there. Your friends are reading them, and they're not taking the time to do the research before it gets to you. So Mr. Murdoch, for being just an overly blatant example of the simple and shallow work of fools who don't even take the time to understand what they're writing, you, sir, are the winner of this week's What a Weenie Award. Well, that'll be it for this episode, podcast number 33 of Indirect Democracy. I would like to thank Matt Bloodwell and the guys at Megaphone for allowing me to use their song, Not Your Enemy, from the album For Crying Out Loud, as the intro and outro music for Indirect Democracy. You can find their music at www.megaphonemusic.net or at their MySpace account, which is myspace.com/megaphone. You can find the links for that band at the favorite links section for the homepage for Indirect Democracy at indirectdemocracy.com. And you can also find their album, For Crying Out Loud, through iTunes. I highly suggest. I still love the song. Take the time, go to the iTunes site, type in Not Your Enemy, download the song. It's a great song. But I, of course, would like to thank you all for listening. Before I end this, just want to say it one more time. November 4th is around the corner. Get out there and vote. And take a friend with you, take your family with you. But get out there and be part of the process. But until that time, I will see you all soon. Take care of each other. Bye for now. Go vote!